ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Kirk, for this week of PBT Extra, I noticed that you're not in your normal spot.
Family vacation, the last chance to kind of, I think, go away as a family before my daughter goes away to college and, you know, things are going to change. So we are down in Baja, California, eating a lot of fish tacos, which are fantastic, and just trying to relax and kind of chill as a family for a few days before. It's funny. Normally, I was like, when we originally booked this, I'm like, you know, in August, Corey, there's nothing going on in the NBA. And that's not really how it turned out to go. So it's been a little working vacation, but like it's still been great to just get away.
You're taking phone calls, writing articles in Baja. You know, how does the fish talk, how do they compare to home?
We're near Ensenada, which is allegedly the birthplace of the fish taco. It was a small fishing village, but I think it's like a lot of places. The best food is the street food, right? It's just this raw, like you're going down the street and you're like, the best food we had so far was this taco. We're like, that looks good. And we were kind of hungry for lunch and we went in and they were cooking them fresh right in front of us. And then what they caught that day and put your own salsas on, they're hand making the tortillas right there. And you know, you all that time you spent in San Antonio, you know, there's nothing like a fresh made tortilla, is there?
No. And you know, this is a deep cut, by the way, just letting you know. There's a way that you can make tortillas, like as far as serving tortillas, the best way to do it, you just put it on the stove. Do you just put the tortilla, you heat them up on the stove directly, right? Not in a pan. You just kind of put them on the actual fire. But that's the best way to do it. And nothing beats like a breakfast taco with a fresh flour tortilla like that.
No, there's a good tortillas. In fact, we ate in last night and we just had gone to the market near here and bought a dozen, whatever they were, the package of tortillas. And we brought them home. We're like, you can't get stuff this good in American market, man. It's so fresh. But they make them there and you just turn them out. And we did just that. We put them over the flame. They were great.
A lot has happened, Kurt, in the basketball world. And I think we should just start by taking a pause and recognizing the giant that was Bill Russell, you know, and ever since the word, his legacy was incomparable. I mean, Commissioner Adam Silver called him the Babe Ruth of basketball. Basketball's Babe Ruth for being able to transcend time. I don't really know much of a better compliment, like, or a better lead to that. But what do you remember about Bill Russell specifically?
Well, I think there's two things. I think that part of it is, I think, you know, we always talk about the 11 championships and everything he did on the court and all that. That may have sold some of that short a little bit in the sense that he really did help change the way basketball was played. It was when he entered the league, you were told as a defender, you know, stay down, stay in your position, stay in front of your man, make him shoot over you. And in comes Russell playing this above the rim, high flying, shot blocking, frankly, just more, you know, it was the way the game was being played in black communities as opposed to kind of the very white NBA at the time. And he starts to change things. He's not alone. Elgin Baylor comes in with his incredibly graceful game, right, and is playing above the rim. But it evolves the NBA really quickly, and Dr. J ends up taking it to another level with the next generation. But, like, it changes the game on the court to something much more like we recognize today. And I'm not sure he gets credit for everything he did there. You know, we talk about the coaching and the championships, but and him being the first black coach and frankly, in American professional sports, wins a couple titles that way. Like everything he did, he really just changed how the game was played on the court and frankly, Corey, that pales in comparison to the off the court stuff.
Yeah, the just to kind of harp on that for a second, to play that tune, I think that's fascinating that he kind of took basketball from a painterly game to a sculptural game in that sense, right? Yeah. 2D to 3D, like adding the vertical, you know, yeah. And like that is it's a pretty amazing innovation. And the fact that, and this is the thing that stands out to me too along those lines, is to have the vision to do that. Yeah. You know, it's one thing to have like the talent, but to have the resolve. And I think the resolve element of his championship quality, his championship character to take not only his team, the Celtics or, you know, San Francisco or, you know, any of the Olympic team to gold, not only taking them all the way every single time, but being able to take the rest of us with him, you know, like take all the people who'd follow in his footsteps, like Dr. J, like Michael Jordan, you know, like all the people that we see now and think this is what basketball is. John Morant is a product of all of these people, right? Like we wouldn't have the game today without the vision that Bill Russell had at a time in which, quite like you said, no one could even conceive of basketball being played that way. Like that's kind of like painting in new colors, you know? That's a crazy idea for me. And now it's just normal. But I think that's the job of a shepherd, and that's the job of a real consummate leader. And then, of course, you know, Kurt, you think about team basketball. Does anyone come to mind that's better than Bill Russell? A guy who's willing to do whatever role. Like, you want me to rebound? I'll rebound. I'll get 50 rebounds in a game. One night he could be Dennis Rodman out there getting, like, you know, all these rebounds. The next night he could be playing against Wilt Chamberlain. You know, like, what? Like, the ability that he had to answer the call and then say, okay, now you want me to be a player coach? Yeah. No worries. I'll get us, you know, 2 championships out of 3 years. It's just unbelievable.
And like you said, his recognition of, like, all right, what we need is rebounding. What we need is defense on the Celtics team, because those Celtics teams were stacked with
Kuzi,
Sam Jones and Casey and on down the line of all these Hall of Famers. They had scoring. They had plenty of guys who could get buckets. Here was the guy who was going to put the anchor in and change the defense and get the boards and make them a championship team. And, oh, yeah, he'd score plenty, but that was not the primary focus. And I love your use of the word resolve for him and just his resolve and determination, because doesn't that really show in every aspect of his life? Like playing through what he had to kind of endure, even in Boston, where I love Vinnie Goodwill, who's on writes for Yahoo. He's on Brother from Another all the time, had a great line where, like, Boston loved Bill Russell 48 minutes at a time. Which I thought was pretty much a perfect explanation for how that city handled him at the time. And to be able to do everything he did and have the resolve to play through it is unbelievable.
And I don't know if you saw President Barack Obama's, you know, comments when he gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Like, that kind of, first of all, is the highest civilian honor for your work. Like you said, off the court, being able to be recognized as a trailblazer, be there for Muhammad Ali during a time when no one else was really, you know, being afraid perhaps to support him, just being on the front line there. I think about Bill Russell I have so much respect for him. This is the best way I can describe the way that, you know, the NBA family, as far as like players are concerned, because remember, I grew up around this.
Yeah.
My dad's a Hall of Famer, so I grew up around the Hall of Famers and the legends. There's one consistent thing, and that's every single legend, I don't care who your favorite legend is, you know, I don't care how big they are, they always say Mr. Russell. They always go right to him and pay their respects. And that's a whole different level where, like, everyone in the game, I mean, being around my dad and going to all these events and all the Hall of Fame events, just the gravitas that Mr. Russell had, and just the gratitude that everyone showed him and the massive respect. And that's what I mean by he was a giant amongst giants. Like that, I mean, to be able to command that kind of respect, but while also airing such a humility and grace, is enviable, to say the least. And yeah, we're going to miss him.
And I, by the way, I think one of my favorite clips we ran at NBC that I think a lot of people saw around this time involved your dad, was the 2017 Lifetime Achievement Award, when your dad and Kareem and Shaq are all out on their, you know, honoring Bill Russell's achievements, and they hand him the trophy and he takes it. And then looks up and down and points at each one of them and just says, I would have kicked your ass. I just loved that competitiveness at 80, whatever he was at the time. Like, just, I love that fire that was still there. And I look, you don't get to be where he was in life without a real sense of competitiveness and a real fire to be the best.
But I also think that there's this element of grace, which is the, which is like the, because sometimes people think, okay, well, you want to win at all costs. And that's kind of like the scorched earth type of winning, you know, and we see that sometimes, you know, particularly in the NBA, where it doesn't matter what I do, like, I'm going to get mine. And to think that that's why he was the ultimate team player, because, I mean, how many players in the NBA today would say, okay, I'm willing to drop my stats. Like, I don't mind if I don't make an all-star team, or I don't mind if I make that little, you know, incentive in my contract to make another $20 million. Like, I don't care about the amount of money. Like, I just want to win. So if you want me to go to this, you know, play this position or come off the bench, you know, I don't need to start, whatever the team needs, like, to that kind of mentality is, like, the only stat that matters is winning. And then I saw this one interview by Tim Duncan. I thought was hilarious. He's like, also, you have to understand, it's underrated, like, how much you have to hate to lose, like, how much you hate losing. And I think Bill Russell also shared that, like, not only do I want to win, but also I hate losing. But then to combine that with that grace of making other people feel like they belong. I remember this one clip. It's one of my favorite stories about Bill Russell, because when he was young and kind of find himself, which is kind of a crazy concept. Could you imagine a young Bill Russell trying to find himself? I felt like he always was so sure of himself. But there was a time, and apparently Mikan, you know, like, one of the ultimate legends, came up to him and said, and just started talking to him. George Mikan just started talking to him as like a peer. And said, when you get to the league, when you do this and this and this. And Bill Russell was like, that was one of the first times that made me feel like I belonged there, you know. And then you hear, like, those, you know, sit down interviews, or the way that Tim Duncan talked about Bill Russell, or the way that Kobe Bryant talked about Bill Russell, like, how he then passed that on, like what George Mikan did for him. He passed it on to future Hall of Famers. I think that's what basketball is all about. And that's why he's the consummate champion.
I would agree. I don't think there's.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. Because we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
There's not going to be, and look, I don't think anybody's ever going to win 11 championships again, but I just don't think there's ever going to be anybody quite like him. How do you feel about the idea of retiring his jersey, his number 6, across the league in a Jackie Robinson kind of way?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting idea.
Let's just say it's getting bounced around. I don't know what will come of it. It's way too early for the NBA to. There's a mourning period. It's way too early to discuss this in a serious way. But I know Magic Johnson supported it, and I think. We'll see what happens, but I think that there's at least some momentum towards the idea.
Yeah, and, you know, Jackie Robinson was a great hero of Mr. Russell's, you know, and it's just interesting to see, you know, he was a pallbearer at Mr. Robinson's funeral as well. So that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I think my gut reaction on these things is to be cautious, but I think that there's one person in NBA history who's kind of deserves that because of their transcendent impact, not only on the game, but on the culture. Like, it would be Bill Russell. So,
and going into baseball, I know we also, we just lost Vin Scully, legendary broadcaster in right around your neck of the woods in Los Angeles. How do you remember Vin Scully?
I don't know. I know there were a lot of tributes out there this morning, and I'm sure there'll be a lot throughout the course of the next couple of days. I don't know, though, how to describe his impact in Los Angeles, especially in an era where, like, when I grew up and, you know, I watched the games on television or I listened to the games on the radio, which, you know, nobody did, or, you know, you didn't know the score sometimes until you saw the paper the next day. His voice was, you know, I think my favorite line is, I'm going to go blank on his name, but the creator of the X-Files, the TV show, the two characters were Fox Mulder and Scully. And he goes, I named it Scully because Scully was the voice of God in LA. And it kind of was. He was this transcendent thing where he was this gentle passionate voice for the sport, but also kind of for the city in some ways. And it's really hard to describe other than, and you'd go to Dodger games at the, you know, when I was growing up and I was watching Oral Hershiser and Kirk Gibson and all these other, and before that, even a little bit, you'd go to games and people would bring handheld transistor radios to the game.
No way.
You hear Vin Scully describe what they were watching, because he was just that, he was that ingrained in the Dodger culture and in Southern California culture. So it's a kind of a, it's just a sad day. He will be missed. It just is. Yeah. It's really hard to describe how he just kind of was part of the fabric of Los Angeles.
There's been a lot of movement, Kurt, in the MLB. We had the trade deadline, and I know this is pro basketball talk, but we have to mention this. I mean, Juan Soto going to the Padres for six players and a lot of young talent there to join Fernando Tatis Jr. and Manny Machado.
Manny Machado,
I can't even, you know, I can't help but draw the parallels to the NBA. We saw that Rudy Gobert trade seems similar. We're looking at another blockbuster trade. Kevin Durant, perhaps, who forced his way out, would command something like that of a massive pirate ship worth of a haul, just like Soto did. The target looks like, once again, this is all coulda, woulda, mighta, maybe, rumors. But the Celtics, and get this, Kurt, they might be willing to part with Jaylen Brown.
Yeah.
Is this a good idea?
First off, I think what makes the Soto thing so wild is he's 23, right? 23, 25? 23, right? Who's that good, that young, that becomes available, right? Like, there's not many people that good, young, that good, but, like, that becomes available to be signed is kind of – it's different than Durant in that sense that as good as Durant is, he's 34. And it's part of why I think Boston – In fact, I'll ask you, Corey, because I think this is the core central debate of putting Jaylen Brown in this deal. If you put Jaylen Brown in, if it's Jaylen, which let's just say it's the first offer they made, Jaylen Brown, Derek White, a pick or two, a couple first-round picks. If you're Boston, you put that in. If you get that trade, you become not just the favorite, you become the heavy favorite, right? Now you've got Tatum, you've got Smart, you've got Robert Williams, all these guys, good bench. You add Durant to that. Durant, with, I think, is an upgrade right now today over what Brown can do in terms of scoring. But your window is now, what, 2 years? Maybe three with that group? And you are going to be the team to beat, but for a couple of years. Whereas, Corey, would you prefer having Brown, who you came up with, the fans have this emotional attachment with, and look, you made the finals last year. And your window with Brown and Tatum is what, 5 years, 7 years?
Maybe if you can keep them together. That's the thing, is the paycheck. And that is like, this is the race against time in Boston, because who knows, maybe they're like the Warriors and willing to get into that luxury tax and be able to keep that core together for a decade plus. I mean, it's doable. We've seen it happen in San Antonio too. You know, they had Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Monta Ginobili for forever, right? So you can do it. You can do it. Will the Celtics be willing to do it? That's another option. Yeah, that's another discussion. And I think the thing that blows my mind here is that we just watched this movie. Like, we just watched it. Kevin Durant left the Warriors to go, you know, be 7-11 with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn, and then they get James Harden. And what happened, though, when they got James Harden, they completely depleted their, like, Jared Allen had to leave. You know, like, all the pieces around them that made Brooklyn very competitive to become that championship competitor all left. Then Joe Harris got injured. And then it was like, yeah, you got three superstars and no one else. Like, you know, and that was one thing that we saw. It's like, man, this Brooklyn went from having one of the best benches in the league to then scrambling and trying to find Patty Mills and trying to wait for Joe Harris to get back. And then the three people couldn't hold them together. Then James Harden forced his way out, and that was that. So for the Celtics to revisit this concept and destroy what is one of the deepest teams in the NBA and this young talent, where in my mind Jaylen Brown is kind of like the emotional leader of that group, because I think Jason Tatum is like the alpha, you know, but I think he's still a little young as far as being able to set the tone like a Steph Curry does. Like, we go as Steph Curry goes. Like, I don't know if Jason Tatum is there yet just as a leader, because he's like, what, he's in his early 20s. Like, he's like, you know, so it takes a long time to get there. But for some reason, Jaylen Brown has this maturity that I've always admired, that I just seem like, it seems like they go as he goes, and Marcus Smart, right? Those two guys, but I think Marcus Smart might be number one, but Jaylen's, I think, two. For them to get rid of him to do exactly what happened in Brooklyn with the same cast of characters, I think would be a massive mistake. And especially if they get rid of like Derek White, I think it's going to be a repeat. You're actually getting weaker there. So in my mind, hold off, keep the course. You're getting close. You're right there.
Look, and they got better this offseason. I think the other thing is that Boston brought in Malcolm Brogdon, like, who solved some of their secondary shot creation issues and depth off the bench and some of the stuff that kind of came up as they got tired of the playoffs. They bring in Danilo Gallinari, who is going to help them a lot in the regular season. How much he helps them, we can debate how much he helps them second round of the playoffs and beyond. But 6'10 guy who can shoot.
Well, you remember like Bielica for the Warriors.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think I would do this. If it was just Brown and White in the pick, I'd have to think about it because Durant, and I'll tell you, when you talk to coaches and GMs, they lean towards win now. They kind of like, well, yeah, but you get Kevin Durant, you probably get a title in the next 2 years. I'll take that over what might happen in the future. And I'm not there. I think this team is so good and so close. That I'm with you. I wouldn't break it up, but I don't think it's, look, if they're asking for, the rumor is that the Nets wanted Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart and picks. And at that point, I think when you get into Marcus Smart, you start really messing with the defensive culture of that team, right? Like and some of their identity in a way that Brown starts to mess with, but two of them,
that's like the whole Boston Celtics team that I think at the current moment, as far as culture wise, you can't touch Marcus Smart at all. And then, like I said, Jaylen Brown, to think that you would be willing to part with him, I think on one side, it's business. I understand that. And he is like, if you're talking about a high level disposable piece, like Jason Tatum is your guy. He's the franchise. Yeah. You can't get rid of him. But if you had to think who's expendable at a high-level player, like All-Star, it would be Jaylen Brown. But I don't think that's a good message you want to send to young people in this league right now where everyone's forcing themselves. They're signing max deals and then forcing themselves out. Like, Kevin Durant just signed a max. Like, he just signed the contract extension. Like, he just signed the contract extension, and then now he requests a trade. So my point is that even if you thought your window was 2 or 3 years, that's not true. That's just not true because we've seen this happen over and over and over again where Toronto probably thought their window with Kawhi Leonard was pretty long with Pascal Siakam and all of them and Fred VanVleet. Next thing you know, he's out. You know, Houston probably thought. So like, it's the same kind of question over and over again we're seeing in the league is, oh, we got a nice window until someone signs a massive deal and forces their way out.
And I think Toronto was a little more wide-eyed as to what might happen with Kawhi, and they were willing to take that risk. I think that's the concern with not only Brooklyn, but like if your other teams that get mentioned, Toronto gets mentioned in Kevin Durant sweepstakes and New Orleans gets mentioned in a Brandon Ingram thing. You have to ask yourself, you have to look at what happened in Golden State. You have to look at what happened now in Brooklyn and see those two situations in Brooklyn where they bent over backwards for him and say, hey, if they can't keep him happy, if he's there a couple of years and wants out, what are we going to do? Like, what's different? Like, I can make a great on-the-court basketball case for New Orleans if you want to, but if he's not going to be happy, what's the point?
Yeah, I think we're talking about, this is like the meta aspect. I think the fans are starting to see, I think, just how precarious and fickle professional sports are in that ego sense. And this is where I think the NBA has, like, clearly gone over into like opera, theater, like, I don't know if you've seen The Red Shoes, it's one of my favorite movies, but Boris Lermontov, like when you're like the proprietor or impresario, when you're like, you know, the managing director of like one of those big theaters or Broadway or anything like that, like the diva might just like not want to go on 20 minutes before show. And your job is just to assuage egos. You have some of the most talented people on planet Earth. And your job is to like tell the diva, like, you're the star, go on and do the show. But then the choreographer is like throwing a fit, and then you got to go do that. And then, hey, on the phone. And you know, the understudy didn't show up. And then it's like, hey, you come from the stands. Like, you get your big break. Like, this is what we're seeing. Like, basketball has become like a streetwear opera in that sense. And I think it's funny because the money is so big, plus like this 24/7 news cycle in the off season where we're looking at videos of LeBron dunking with his kids at a practice facility. Like that's news now, you know, like what people are wearing at fashion shows, Carl Anthony Towns at Paris Fashion Week. That's news. Who's dating who? That's news. All these things combined, mixed in with this idea that you sign a quarter of a billion dollar contract every 5 years, means that, you know, we're into the era of divas. But what that means too is, as a team, you got to realize, what can a diva do for you? And I think that is a really essential question. Like, if you want to be, like, I always say, like a Las Vegas residency, if you want to be Broadway and just say, hey, this A-list movie star who, regardless of the quality of team, is going to sell it. That's like the definition of a movie star. Regardless of the quality of movie, like, you will still make a profit. So when you think about movie stars in the NBA, it's like LeBron James. It doesn't matter how good the team is. Like, if he's on the team, you're turning a profit, because home away, people are going to buy the jerseys. They're going to show up. You're still going to be on TV. There's only like 5, maybe 10 guys, maybe, in the entire NBA that hit that movie star box office draw. So if you want to go after one of them, and your job is like, you're thinking profit lines and you're thinking that way, go for it. But if you're thinking about winning a championship, what can a diva do for you? And this is my last point on this. I know it's kind of a long, you know, diatribe, but it's important, I think, because Steph Curry is a perfect example. Tim Duncan, a perfect example. Those guys define the culture, and it doesn't matter. You add or subtract around them, the culture doesn't get affected. Same thing with Steph Curry, but with Kevin Durant, I don't think he's that. And we saw that in Brooklyn, and then with Boston, Jason Tatum isn't there yet. So if you're going to get rid of everybody and just expect Jason Tatum and Kevin Durant to be that, that's like what we saw Kyrie Irving, who wasn't that, and Kevin Durant, who wasn't that. It's going to be the same type of thing. You need a Steph Curry, because Steph can win without Kevin Durant, and he can win with Kevin Durant.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought those two guys up, because that was the thing I've been thinking, was that you need a guy setting the culture who wants to be coached and who will hold people accountable. Tim Duncan may have been the ultimate with that. Willingness to be coached hard by Popovich, and because he would, then everybody else was going to fall in lines. I think it's much the same way with Curry, even though it's a looser vibe maybe than a Popovich era team in Golden State. Like, the same accountability is there, and Draymond's more the voice, but Curry sets that tone. You're right. Some of these guys either don't set that tone the same way, or you can set a Kobe Bryant-like tone, but not everybody's going to be comfortable playing in that, right? Like, that's a different vibe, and it's, some guys are going to thrive in it and some guys aren't. It's kind of fascinating. I think I'm with you. I think every one of these teams looking at a Kevin Durant trade, and you talk about Jaylen Brown, every time I start to think, I'm like, maybe I do that. I'm like, 25 for 34. Trade a 25-year-old for a 34-year-old. And I don't know.
Yeah, it's, I know. I know. And the thing about the whole movie star box office draw too, is that, like I said, there's only a handful, maybe 5 or 10. The crazy thing about this, Kurt, is that those pillars that you're talking about, like the Tim Duncan type of pillars, Steph Curry type of pillars, there's only like 2 or 3, like in the league. Yeah. So that's what, so is, that's what's even crazier about this. So if you are thinking, as a team, that is just like I think from Boston perspective, don't look at the shiny object, stay focused and keep going. But I mean, we're ultimately, I feel like we might be seeing, not only in this regard, but a power shift more generally in the league. And I'd love to hear your perspective on it. I know you're always talking about the MVP odds, but I'd love to hear what you got from me on the power shifting in the NBA.
Well, I think it was interesting because we talked about this a little last time in the office. I put up a post about the odds this week through our partners, NBC partners at PointsBet, about MVP odds. And who are your three favorites? Luka Doncic is number one, and tied for number two are Giannis Antetokounmpo and Joel Embiid, with Jokic, the two-time winner, third, fourth. And I get why he's fourth, because, I mean, the last guy to three-peat was Larry Bird 40 years ago. Like, it's unlikely. And I'm not saying he can't do it. It's just that's a mountain to climb. But all four players I just mentioned, they are not American-born. They're not, like, they are – I mean, Embiid came out of Kentucky and the American system a little bit, but it is a shift in terms of these are guys who came out of systems where team basketball was more first than the kind of individualized basketball that comes through the AAU system. And maybe that is an impact. And it's I know it's discussed around the NBA. I mean, I think you've seen it.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is the road widening, right?
Yeah.
So, and this is why in the context of our conversation around divas, this is really fascinating. I love this comment by Luka Doncic. He was on JJ Redick's podcast. And he's like, yeah, man, I was trying to get Jokic to, like, get an Instagram. And he's like, no chance. And Luka was trying to explain to JJ, you know, you can make a lot of money in doing TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and all this stuff. But like he was saying that Jokic just loves his horses. The guy just loves horses and he's not in the, you know, he's not
in the videos of him just on horses this summer.
So I'm sitting here and I'm like, that's why this dude's the man. And I feel like we're seeing two different the divergence though on the elite level. And we're not talking about role players, because I think that's a whole different. I'm talking about like the cream of the crop. Who are the faces of the NBA talent-wise? All those players are European or international players. And I think that the way that they operate is just so different than like the superstar diva way that this generation in America operates. Because I think there's like this pre-professional program where it's very much like, you know, you get discovered by Disney Channel, you know, you're a child actor, and then you want to go be, you know, a movie star or whatever. But then you either pan out because the hype was too large, or, you know, you become some sort of amazing talent. I think that this kind of latent fame in the European system is a good thing, quite frankly, because Jokic was a second round draft pick.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, Giannis wasn't top five, you know?
Nope.
So you think about like some of this latent fame, I think is a good thing for these guys, because I think expectations are a little off. And the fact that Jokic is a back-to-back MVP, which is like a short list. You're talking to guys like LeBron James, like Kareem, like the thing that he could become like Larry Bird. And he's not even, when you think, if you're going to ask somebody randomly on the NBA, who's like one of the best players in the history of the NBA? And if you're thinking about a three-peat of an MVP, I don't know if people would just immediately say, oh, Jokic.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I don't know, but I think he's got to secure his legacy more in the postseason. And by the way, I think that can start this year. They're finally healthy with Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. And knock on wood, you know, if they're healthy, they're going to be a dangerous team come the playoffs. It's a long time away, but like, I think you can start to secure a little more of that. But that's the European system is just, you know, if you come up as an AAU star, if you're Jason Tatum or Ja Morant or Devin Booker, and by the time you're 14, the ball is in your hands pretty much every time down the court in an isolation set, right? Like, you're going into these games, these AAU coaches want to win, your high school coach wants to win, and they know the best way to do that is just to give their best player the ball all the time. And I don't know, you get the players who come out of the European system where it's a more team-based, a lot more cutting, a lot more ball movement, partially because of the way the rules are enforced and the physicality that's allowed. But you get a lot more of that. I think once they translate that to the NBA, you see Jokic is an MVP in part because he's the best passing big man we have ever seen. Like, he just, if you cut around Jokic, you will be rewarded, right? If you cut around Doncic, you will be rewarded. Giannis is kind of his own. He is the Greek freak. There's just not another Giannis. But his playmaking skills are better. He's improved. He sets guys up. And I think that broader range sometimes allows you to excel as an individual but lift your teammates up in a way. I'm not sure. Maybe it just takes longer for a Jason Tatum to learn that.
No, I think it's actually – this is what happens in my opinion.
Okay.
Because of that system you described in America and the fact that, by the way, not like – in other countries and stuff, it's all connected, like federation all the way down. So it's a consistent level of coaching because it's run by the same organization. Whereas in the United States, like anyone can start, you know, anyone can have an AAU team. Like anyone can like coach, you know, these kind of teams. So you're learning all these different styles of coaching by people who may or may not be good coaches. And then by the time you get to college, which you're only going to spend a semester there, and then you're going to the league, it's a pre-professional program, or you just go straight to the G League. So let's say, for instance, you get 18 years of wildly inconsistent coaching, right? Then you get to the league and you finally meet a master. You get Eric Spoelstra, you get Eric Spoelstra, you get, Coach Popovich, you get, Brad Stevens coaching you basketball now, Steve Kerr coaching you. And they're like, wait a second, where are the fundamentals? where are all the basic building blocks? You have the athletic talent, you've been playing off of talent. Now let's break you down, and then teach you the fundamentals and then build you back up. The issue is, one, the ego point of that. I was a number one draft pick. I was the first round draft pick in the NBA. What I've been doing has brought me this far. I'm a millionaire now. I come from nothing or whatever. What do you mean you want to change my shot? What do you mean I don't know how to play basketball? That is hard enough. And then the second part, too, is the fan expectation. We're paying this guy a lot of money, and it's going to take you 5 or 7 years to get him back to a place, take him down and build him back up. What if he doesn't perform? We're going to trade him. We're going to ask, we're going to come from somebody's head and someone's going to get fired. And I think that's what you see in some of these places where you have great coaching, where people are just, their patience gets, exhausted. People are like, okay, we're not going to wait 5 years for whatever, Van Gundy to teach these New Orleans Pelicans how to play basketball,
Yep. I think that's why it's one of the reasons I think Kawhi Leonard got to be a success. And I think Jonathan Kuminga could be the same kind of thing. Because he went there, he goes to San Antonio, and they can bring him along slowly and take advantage of teaching him how to use that athleticism in a proper way in a team game, because we already got Duncan and Ginobili and Parker. We're going to win a ton of games, so it doesn't matter. Isn't that sort of where Jonathan Kuminga and, to a degree, Moody is, right?
And James Wiseman and Jordan. I think the entire team, that's why the Warriors, to me, that's why Andrew Wiggins, that's why in my opinion, he's experienced a revival, a renaissance, because he went through that system of, top draft pick, be the guy. But then as you're trying to unlearn and then relearn, the team is failing. And then it's like, we signed you on this huge contract. Goodbye. Good riddance. Now he had protection and culture. And it's also the thing about culture is that, in the sense of protection, it doesn't necessarily matter if you have one or two down seasons. Like, remember when Steph broke his hand? Because they're like, Kerr isn't going to get fired, after one bad season. Whereas, Frank Vogel won a championship in L.A. and was fired, a couple of years later. So the fact that there is that stability there, it's okay. Spoelstra's not going to get fired if Miami Heat have a bad season, But he's still going to be able to teach Tyler Hero how to play basketball.
Stability of culture, I think. And I think that goes to ownership. It's the ownership. Good ownership remains the greatest secret weapon in pro sports, but stability of ownership and stability of culture and style. Like you said, the Heat are the Heat. They're going to be the Heat. And the Spurs are that way to a degree. Popovich will step away whenever Popovich wants to step away, but probably in the next few years. You really don't think their culture is changing, right? It's not going to – nothing is really shifting for them. Whereas, by the way, just as a counter, you're really seeing a shift in how Utah does things, largely since the Millers gave up ownership and Ryan Smith comes in and buys the team. And it's not necessarily good or bad, but it is definitely a shift in how they're trying to approach things, because that started at the top. And I think consistency – over time matters so much. He's like, especially if you're not in, the Knicks are going to make money regardless because they're the Knicks, and the Lakers will make money because they're the Lakers. And I'm not to knock those two ownerships in particular, but if you're in Miami or if you're in Utah or if you're in San Antonio or if you're in Memphis, you need that consistency of organization to make it really work, because you can't just reset the button and go get a free agent like some teams can.
Now, I want to spend the last couple minutes we have, Kurt, talking food. food culture. I think that's one part of the game. We understand the theatrical nature of basketball at this point. What about the food? What are some of your favorite foods that you've had at an arena? Where are we going?
I'm curious, too, because you've certainly done a lot of this. I will, first off, I have to shout out the Boston Celtics, because – and if you go screaming back through their Twitter timeline all the way to the playoffs, I think they had it up. I know that NBC Sports Boston did. Before game 3 of the NBA Finals this year, and if anybody, you've heard media members, or Corey, you've eaten in pregame meals in an arena served to the media, it's chicken or beef. And it's kind of, how should I put this? It's wedding food. It's country club, you know, out of a chafing dish buffet type of food. They had lobster from before game three. They had crab. They had this huge ice cream. It was the best pregame spread I've ever seen. So I got to give a shout out to that. But I don't know. I think that what I love that's evolved over the last few years, Corey, is a lot of arenas, almost every arena, seems to have gone out into the community and brought in like popular famed chefs or restaurants from that region to open a mini satellite and within the arena. So that, you know, if you're in Memphis now, you can actually get like a rendezvous pulled pork sandwich in the FedEx form, which is like, their ribs are unbelievable. It's a must go place if you're in Memphis, but you can get some of that in the arena. You know, my personal memory, and I know in LA, like if I'm feeling fancy that night, Ludo Lefebvre, a kind of famed French chef, he has a chicken place in Staples Center that does really good chicken for arena food. Like I'll run up occasionally and get some. So those come out, but then for me, it's always the stuff I'm emotionally attached to. So like, I don't know about you, Corey. Like I said, we talked about Vin Scully earlier, and I grew up in LA. There's nothing like a Dodger dog. I'm going to a Dodger game in a couple of weeks. I will have at least one, if not two, Dodger dogs. And it's not ideal. It's probably not nutritionist approved, but you have that emotional attachment to stuff at a ballpark, and it will never change, right? Do you have of that?
Yeah, for me, it's hot chocolate at Notre Dame. Because the first time I ever went to Notre Dame, it was like November. It was for a Navy game. It was November. It was so cold. And I was with my dad because we went to watch Navy play. I didn't know much about Notre Dame at the time. And I wanted to be a student. I wasn't being recruited or anything. And I had hot chocolate there. So every time I'm back on campus, and you know, like every time I think about football, especially Notre Dame football, I just think about my first hot chocolate from the Knights of Columbus little stand at Notre Dame. So that was my version of the Dodger dog. I also think the best sushi, the best food I've had around the different NBA arenas, sushi in Sacramento. They had really good sushi there.
Yes. Yeah, they do.
And then the other one I had that was really good, I had some pretzels, like sugary pretzels in L.A., Wetzel's pretzels.
Oh, Wetzel's pretzels are good, yeah.
And I remember I was like, I think it was for an All-Star weekend when I was there, and I was like I kept going up. Like, it was one of those things where like it was interesting with the action I was seeing, but like, the pretzels were so good. I missed so much of that All-Star weekend because I was just waiting in line to get pretzels. And I was like, man, that's really good pretzels. So those are some of my
thoughts. I love that the local food stuff, like I said, like I last time the All-Star game was in New Orleans, they gave us, you know, we were able to eat at the arena stands. I had gumbo like three nights in a row sitting there. Like it was really good gumbo served. You can get in the arena. I think that happens a lot of places now, and we're all a little fatter for it, but maybe it's good.
It's okay. It's if you want to learn more about what Kurt and his amazing team is doing as far as PBT, go to NBCSports.com/PBTExtra for all the latest news. Kurt, we'll see you next week.
I look forward to it, Corey. Take care.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.